Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's been almost 50 years since Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated on April 4th, 1968. While his famous I Have a Dream speech is played over and over again on his birthday, most media outlets ignore his vehement opposition to the Vietnam War, his warnings about increased militarization, and the struggles he faced in his final year, including denunciations by the press, dismissal by the country's black middle class and militants, and assaults on his character, ideology, and political tactics. In his new book, Death of a King, The Real Story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Final Year, today's guest, Tavis Smiley, writes that the martyrdom of Martin Luther King Jr. has undermined his message. As a public figure who fearlessly challenged the status quo, he's been sanitized and oversimplified. The values for which he lived and died, justice for all, service to others, and a love that liberates, no matter the cost, are largely forgotten. He's no longer a threat, but merely an idealistic dreamer to be remembered for a handful of his speeches. Tavis Smiley captures the troubles Dr. King faced in his last 12 months, from his impassioned speech against the Vietnam War to his assassination that took place exactly 1 year later. And during this time, MLK faced adversity from virtually every segment of society, most painfully his own people. And during that time, he was campaigning for a lot of the same things that people in the U.S. are still plagued by today: poverty, racism, militarization. So how far has the movement come since the death of Martin Luther King Jr., and how should we remember the famous civil rights leader? Tavis Smiley is host and managing editor of Tavis Smiley on PBS and The Tavis Smiley Show from Public Radio International. He's the author of 16 books, including his newest, Death of a King, The Real Story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Final Year. And Tavis joins us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Hi, Tavis. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Good to be back on again. How are you?
I'm good. It's great to have you.
So, glad to be here.
You put out this book this month on purpose to have a conversation about the last year of MLK's life. You've pointed out that if you put it out in January, it's a holiday. We get the I Have a Dream over and over again. And he's almost treated like a nice soft teddy bear, right? Whereas so much of what you write about in your book is completely ignored and forgotten.
It is ignored and forgotten in part because it's so much easier, Rose, to celebrate dead martyrs, because dead martyrs aren't here to challenge us. They're not here to hold us accountable. They're not here to demand that the truth be told about their life and about their legacy. So that, you're right, we have, how might I put this, we have deified him in death, but we demonized him in life, especially in the last year of his life.
Why is this an important story to tell now? Why do you want us to have this conversation now?
Great question. In part because he's been too sanitized, sterilized, romanticized, lionized, in some ways demonized. But the truth has not really been told about him. Let me just say right quick, because I always want to acknowledge the three principal biographers of Dr. King: Taylor Branch, David Garrow, and Claiborne Carson. They've done the heavy lifting, as it were, to lay out the history of the life and legacy of Dr. King. But this is the first book ever to look just at that last year. I believe, Rose, that whether we're talking about Tavis Smiley or Rose or anybody listening right now, as human beings, we come to know who we really are, who we truly are, in the dark and difficult days of our lives. And if you think you know Dr. King, but you don't know how he navigated the darkest and most difficult days of his journey, which happened to be for him literally the last year of his life, then you don't really know him. And so I think that because he's been so so romanticized, we need to get a full and clear view of who he really was, who he was not, and really how he navigated the last year of his life when everything and everybody turned against him.
When we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday in January, I love reading this article by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's Jeff Cohen and Norman Solomon. They wrote it back in January of 95, called "The Martin Luther King You Don't See on TV." And they basically say that you get this loop of his speeches: King battling desegregation in Birmingham in 1963, reciting his dream of racial harmony at the rally in Washington 1963. I mean, you even see this stuff on Fox News. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy just to say, well, the media are corporate and that's why this happens. But why do you think this message is so sanitized? Because there's more to it than that, right?
Yeah, because the truth, Rose, that he was trying to tell us is just too subversive. Put another way, the truth is just too hot for us to handle. And so we tend to focus on the parts of his message that are easy for us to swallow, easy for us to navigate. And so the March on Washington, as you mentioned a moment ago, is the speech we most often focus on. I think people think he only gave one speech in his life, and they think that speech only had one line in it, that I want my children to live in a nation where they'll not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Hold the phone. On April 4, 1967, when he goes to the Riverside Church in Manhattan and delivers this speech beyond Vietnam, it becomes the most controversial talk in his life precisely because in that speech, Rose, he refers to his country, to America, as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. This is a black man in the 60s telling America, you America, are the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. So the next day, when every major newspaper turned on him, and you mentioned Fox News a moment ago, I don't mean the conservative media. I mean the New York Times turned on him. The liberal Washington Post turned on him. Time Magazine turned on him. But everybody came after him the next day. So it starts with the media. Then the Johnson White House turns on him. Then white folk turn on him. The last poll, very quickly, taken in his life, the Harris Poll, Rose, found that 75%, three-quarters of the American people thought he was irrelevant in the last year of his life. And hold your hat, almost 60% of black people thought he was persona non grata. So the NAACP and Roy Wilkins, the Urban League and Whitney Young, Ralph Bunche, the only other black Nobel laureate living, comes after him. Adam Clayton Powell Jr. comes after him. But I can't even repeat on radio what Thurgood Marshall said about Dr. King. This is the kind of pushback he's getting in the last year of his life.
Hmm. Well, talk a little bit about what was going on behind the scenes, because you write that during this time, he faced adversity from virtually every segment of society, most painfully his own people. So what was going on on behind the scenes?
Well, the Johnson White House had worked with Dr. King, of course, to pass the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, two of the most, perhaps the two most seminal pieces of legislation in the entire 20th century. But they worked closely with Dr. King to get that legislation passed. King was in and out of the White House regularly. The tapes are all out now. You can hear him on the phone talking to Johnson any number of times about how to get this legislation passed. So he was very friendly with the Johnson administration. He appreciated the fact that Johnson, having taken over from Kennedy, was really interested in getting something done. And so they became, colleagues and partners in this fight to get voting rights and civil rights passed. But when Martin comes out against the war in Vietnam, LBJ and his staff at the White House don't like the way he's holding them accountable in such a public way. And so the White House did what White Houses do behind the scenes, to answer your question. They call their Negro friends. And these Negroes basically became White House surrogates. So while they're wonderful individuals in their own right and have made great contributions, they were wrong about this. But Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young and Ralph Bunche and Adam Clayton Powell was not on the White House payroll, but Carl Rowan certainly was a White House surrogate, leading journalist of the time. So the White House starts maneuvering through black media and black leaders for them to check Martin publicly, and they did that, and it hurt Dr. King to his heart.
Hmm. He struggled on really both sides, right? Because you had a lot of militant civil rights activists who didn't like his nonviolent policies, and people supporting his nonviolent policies didn't support him speaking out against the war. So he was being pulled on both sides.
You're right. So the bourgeois elite Negroes, they didn't like Martin at this point. They were over him because he was basically out of step with them. They thought that Martin pushing back on the president was a mistake. Why? Because Johnson had been the best friend that Negroes had had in the White House since Lincoln freed the slaves, and they didn't like Martin sort of biting the hand that had fed them. So the bourgeois elite Negroes are mad at him for, getting into it with the president and pushing back on him publicly. But the everyday black people, and certainly the younger black people, the younger Negroes in that era, even though Martin King is only 38 at the time, Rose, he's old man for them. He's passé, nonviolence is out of step. So they want to hear black power. They want to hear Stokely Carmichael and H. Rap Brown and Huey Newton. And King's thing was, I love these young brothers, but black power is a slogan. It's not a strategy.
Hmm. He also had to deal with the FBI as a constant background presence in the last year of his life, wiretapping his phones, composing secret press releases to discredit him. You write about King expressing reluctance to see a psychologist for his mental health because of concerns over the FBI listening in. This is also a piece of the story that we don't often hear when there's all these celebrations in January.
Yeah, King was was hospitalized rose a number of times over the last couple of years for what was officially regarded as, you know, or certainly officially labeled as exhaustion. And to be sure, he was exhausted. He was on the move all the time, so he was certainly exhausted. But there was, I think, some mania. There was certainly some depression and some despondency. And there were a couple of people in his camp who were trying to get him to go see a therapist. And there were others in his camp who said, absolutely not. Under no condition will we ever see a therapist. Harry Belafonte, King's dearest friend, one of his dearest friends, writes in his book, Belafonte, that is, that he was seeing a therapist, and he and Martin even talked about therapy. He told Martin what he thought the values of therapy were. So there were people in his camp, indeed friends like Belafonte, who didn't see anything wrong with him seeing a therapist, but there were others who were like, are you crazy? Do you know what J. Edgar Hoover would do with the information that Martin is seeing a psychiatrist? And so for a number of reasons, principally because they didn't want that used against him, it never actually happened. But there were times, back to the point, where Martin was depressed because when you got that much hell and that much hate coming at you and everybody who you've worked with has turned on you, that can be tough to navigate.
You also say that he wasn't really prepared. He thought he was prepared for the press reaction to his anti-war speech, but he wasn't. You write about just what was going through his mind, or what would have gone through his mind on a long flight from New York to Los Angeles.
Yeah. He had been told that he knew there was going to be some backlash. Let me just back up. Most of the folk on his staff, Rose, did not want him to give this speech. Another part of the book that people will find fascinating. Dr. King only established one entity in his life, and it was the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC. Fascinating to note that his own organization, his own board of directors, voted to sanction him against speaking out so publicly against the war in Vietnam. Even they thought that was a lane that he had no business running in. And so they passed a resolution condemning him in his own organization, his board of directors. And so his team wasn't even with him. He called his team at SCLC a team of wild horses. He couldn't get their support on the Vietnam speech. He couldn't get their support on his Poor People's Campaign. So within his own camp, he was having difficulty trying to kind of coalesce them. But it was, again, a difficult journey for him all the way around.
When did the FBI start monitoring him and, you know, going after his character? Yeah. Was he considered a danger before speaking out against the Vietnam War?
Well, the first question, when did they start? Well, before he knew it, that's for sure. There were people inside his own inner circle who were on the FBI payroll. It's painful to research and read all of this. And again, his biographers have put much of this out there. But when you look at it in the context of what he was up against just in that last year, which is what this book, Death of a King, is all about, it's sad to accept the fact that his treasurer, James Harrison, is on the FBI payroll. His personal photographer is on the FBI payroll. We know that Ernest Withers, we now know, was on the famous photographer on the FBI payroll. He was around King all the time. So there are folk inside of his camp who were reporting back every day what they heard and what they saw. And to your point, Rose, he's under surveillance every day, wiretapped all the time. But here's the beauty of this story. With all that surveillance and all that wiretapping, I don't know what they would find. I don't know what they'd find, Rose, if they heard me and you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But Martin is under surveillance and being wiretapped all the time, and he's got spies inside of his own camp. And not one time, not a single solitary time, Rose, do we ever hear Dr. King, ever, contesting the humanity of any other individual. Nothing derogatory, nothing derisive, nothing demeaning, nothing demonizing. What's your point, Tavis? The point is that love ethic that he talked about was part of his DNA, and he lived in private what he talked about in public. And what a beautiful thing it is every now and again to research an icon all these years later who holds up under the scrutiny of history and turns out to be exactly who I thought he was.
Tavis Smiley is out with a new book about the real king. It's called Death of a King, the real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. And Tavis spent decades reading, discussing, and analyzing Dr. King's work, but this is the first time he has sought to capture his feelings about King in a book. Tavis writes, "After decades of study, I have come to firmly believe that in critical ways, Dr. King is misunderstood, and that misunderstanding is robbing us of the essence of his character and his crusade." So we'd love to hear from you. We've done many, many shows about Dr. King. What are your thoughts about the last year of his life and what he stood for? If you remember that Vietnam speech, we'd love to hear from you. What did you think of it at the time? And what effect do you think it has on us today? I mean, there was just a debate yesterday or this week about what's happening with ISIS and President Obama's plans to call on military action on Iraq and Syria. The toll-free number is 866-798.
You're listening to a rebroadcast episode of Your Call. We can't accept phone calls at this time.
He did on King's last year and what he found. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Tavis, you write that you first heard or were moved by Dr. King when you were a young boy growing up in a trailer park in rural Indiana. And you have watched the documentaries, you've read the books on your shows, you have all of these people on your shows. What did you learn this time around that was new? What was there a moment where you said, wow, that's one thing that I have not heard yet?
Yeah, I learned a few things. Some of them were smaller, but they were significant to me. The most important thing, and I'll come to those small things in a second, but the most significant thing, Rose, was I knew that he was up against, a serious headwind. I did not know that the headwinds were as strong as they were. I mean, Martin dies alone, and that's the most depressing thing to consider, that even though you see people in the picture with him and there are people around him all the time, he died alone. Because everybody and everything had turned on him, he couldn't. I mean, he must have felt like the cosmos had shifted against him. He couldn't get support amongst his own team. He's bankrupt. He's smoking a bit heavy, drinking a bit more, gaining a lot of weight. They did the autopsy on him after he was dead, of course, and he dies at 39. But he has the insides, Rose, of an almost 65-year-old man. His organs. So the pressure and the stress was really starting to eat him up. And the way that he got up every day and navigated forward and kept telling the truth against all the odds is the most, it's the most inspiring part of this story. But I also learned smaller things that I had not seen reported before. Like, for example, there's a wonderful singer who used to sing background for Ray Charles. She was one of the Raylettes. Had a couple records of her own before she actually joined Ray Charles and the Raylettes. And she was in Memphis at Stax Records to record her new project. And she was in the room, room 306, the room that King stayed in. She was in that room when Dr. King came to town to Memphis. And that was his favorite room. And so the hotel manager and the owner went to her and said to her, Dr. King is coming in this afternoon, and this happens to be his favorite room. Would you mind moving to another room and letting Dr. King have this room? Well, we know what happens. King goes into the room and steps out on that balcony. It's such a clean shot to hit him. But I wonder what might have happened had he been in another room that day and not in that room 306, and she left that room to make space for Dr. King. So there are all kinds of little interesting tidbits that come together for this book. But again, those three biographers have done a wonderful and rich job of putting so much of this history in their brilliant text.
Tavis Smiley's latest book is Death of a King, The Real Story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Final Year. And let's hear from a few listeners before we go to break. Let's go to Marie Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, Marie Louise. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you. I feel that Martin Luther King Jr. was such an amazing man, and I often have had this feeling that people aren't up to really wanting to acknowledge the hugeness and strength of a person and the things that he said. It's easier for people to sort of, well, give him a prize, say he's great, consider him a hero, but not really go beyond that. And because it would demand more of us.
Uh-huh.
So I just feel like, and how much I honor the fact of what he spoke out against the Vietnam War and his country, which, our countries are not holy in their how they're run. So, yes, we're supposed to be against wrongness, and I honor him immensely. So I thank you for doing this program. Thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Thank you. That was a powerful comment, Rose. She put it so succinctly and yet so brilliantly. which is that to come into the truth of what Martin was really trying to get us to see and to understand demands more of us. And she put that right where it belongs. It does demand more of us. When Martin King talks about the triple threat of racism, poverty, and militarism, and how that is going to ultimately destroy our democracy, to fix that, that means we have to do some work. So he demands more of us. If you want to really honor King's legacy, which I think, Rose, is about justice for all, service to others, and a love that liberates people, we've got work to do. King said all the time, life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? So her comment resonates with me.
I can't help but think about what we're dealing with today, especially as Dr. King said, quote, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death, end quote. And the National Priorities Project just put out some information this week about the Pentagon, saying we're going to spend about $7.5 million per day on airstrikes in Iraq. When you were doing the research, Tavis, and looking at what we're facing today, how do you kind of connect the dots between the two? What goes through your mind?
Yeah, a couple of things. As I was working on the finishing touches of this text, just before it comes out, the Ferguson situation, you know, blew up. And here we are almost 50 years after King's death, where he's talking about the triple threat of racism, poverty, and militarism. What do we see in Ferguson? Racism, poverty, and militarism. And then I see the first black president of the United States with a peace prize. So what you really have is a war president with a peace prize, the same peace prize that Dr. King has. I have great respect for President Obama. I voted for him twice like everybody else. And yet he and Martin both have peace prizes. Of course, then again, Henry Kissinger has a peace prize too. That's another conversation for another time. But Obama has the same peace prize that Martin has. That just doesn't square, because he's a war president with a peace prize. And if Martin were here now, while he would have campaigned for Barack Obama, no doubt about it, would have been happy that he won, no doubt about it, he then would have become his critic. Because on the issue of poverty and racism and militarism, Martin King would have had something to say. And the truth of the matter is, and people don't like it when I say this, and they call me a hater and a, you know, I'm a hater and I'm too tough on the president. I love him. I voted for him. He got my vote, and I'm going to hold him accountable. End of subject. But the point is this. Barack Obama has a drone program, overseeing a drone program on steroids. He has used more drones than George Bush did. He's killed more innocent women and children than George Bush did. And somebody ought to say that. Now, that's not hating on the president to speak that kind of uncomfortable, inconvenient truth. And I told somebody the other day, Rose, if you think that I'm tough on Obama, wait till you read this book, Death of a King, and you see what King said about Johnson. I mean, when you read what Martin said about Johnson, and quite frankly, to President Johnson, man, I'm treating Obama with kid gloves compared to the way Martin treated President Johnson.
Can you share one line before we go to break in about 30 seconds, what he said to Johnson?
Well, he basically said Johnson had no business running for re-election. He said he does not need to be our president. Can you imagine what would happen if Tavis Smiley had said at the end of the first term, Barack Obama ain't got no business running for re-election? They would have hung me up, and I don't mean in effigy.
Well, your brother Cornel West has said some things like that, and look at what's happened to him.
Case in point.
Right. Tavis Smiley's latest book is Death of a King, the real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. And like so many, Tavis has spent decades reading, discussing, and analyzing Dr. King's work. But this is the first time he has sought to really capture his feelings about King in a book. He says he's come to firmly believe that in many ways, King is misunderstood, and that misunderstanding is robbing us of the essence of his character. So Tavis looks at the last 365 days of Martin Luther King. What kind of man had he become? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I'm speaking with Tavis Smiley about his latest book, Death of a King, the real story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-792.
You're listening to a rebroadcast episode of Your Call, so we are not accepting phone calls at this time.
Final year. And the speech he gave about the Vietnam War. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can leave us a comment, yourcallradio.org. Tavis Smiley is host and managing editor of Tavis Smiley on PBS and The Tavis Smiley Show from Public Radio International. And let's go next to Ed in Santa Cruz. Hi, Ed.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to bring up another very subversive statement that Martin Luther King made. It's called, it's an essay called Loving Your Enemies. And he recognized that it was very difficult to love your enemies, but there it is in the Bible, in the Sermon on the Mount, Christ telling people that's what they have to do, love your enemies. He said in the essay that the most important thing to realize is that Christ is not an idealist. He's not a dreamer. He said it's the only way to break the cycle of violence is to open up to your enemies. Sit down with them across the table. Treat them like human beings, because everyone, is not the sum of their crimes. Their people are, have many aspects to their personality. He says we must recognize that the evil deed of the enemy neighbor, the thing that hurts, never quite expresses all that he is. An element of goodness may be found even in our worst enemy, and so on and so on. I mean, this is very subversive. This is the thing that we need to focus on, is to loving our enemies instead of, as John McCain would have it, search out and destroy our unpardonable enemies. That was his speech in 2004.
Yeah. So, Rose, his comment points up something that you referenced earlier in this conversation about how dangerous a man was he. At one point, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI listed Dr. King as the most dangerous man in America. Now think about that. Martin Luther King Jr., the most dangerous man in all of America. The only weapon that Martin Luther King Jr. ever used was love. Was love. And the caller is absolutely on point. So just think about that later today. Just marinate on that for a couple of days. What does it mean that a man who was using the power of love as his weapon was so dangerous that the FBI had him at the top of the list? But that, I hope that is instructive and informative for those of us today who think that love is not pregnant with the kind of power that I think it still is to make a difference in the world.
Well, and speaking of the love, you write about a time when Dr. King met with a dozen prostitutes that he met on the street, offered them coffee and sandwiches in the hotel lobby, and listened to their opinions and their points of view. I mean, these are other stories and little nuggets that are really important when you think back on his life.
That's one. There are a number of things in this book, as you know, that are kind of funny. But that is the funniest story in the world to me. Dr. King's in a car one day in Cleveland with Bernard Lee and Andy Young, comes to a stop sign. I'll tell the story very quickly. Comes to a stop sign. These prostitutes, about a dozen of them, look in the car, and they see it's Dr. King, and they start chiding him, calling Uncle Tom, and go back down south. We don't need you here. This is the kind of disrespect that Dr. King was getting in the last year of his life, because they wanted to talk about black power and Stokely Carmichael. So how is it that Dr. King is being called an Uncle Tom? Get out of here, go back down south. This is Dr. King. And he's being called these names by a bunch of prostitutes on the corner. So the light turns green, whatever. They pull away. And Doc says to Bernard and Andy, turn the car around. They said, Doc, we're going to be late for this church. We got to go. Doc says, turn the car around. Andy says, Doc, they're just prostitutes. Don't worry about it. They're just kids. They don't know. Doc said, turn the car around, Andy. They turn the car around and go back. Dr. King pops out the car. These prostitutes are stunned now, because this is King in front of them. And he wants to know why they feel that way about him. And he goes on to explain to them why he's fighting for them and what his mission is all about, et cetera, et cetera. Then he says, I got to go. Do me a favor. I'm staying at the Sheraton. At 3 o'clock, meet me at the Sheraton, and we can continue this conversation. You can imagine, Rose, the surprise of the hotel clerk when a dozen prostitutes walk in the hotel and say, we're here to meet Dr. King. He invited us over. He calls Dr. King's room. He says, yeah, I did tell them to come. Please put them in the conference room, get them some sandwiches and coffee and donuts and things, and I'll be right down. He He went downstairs, and for hours, he sat and talked to those prostitutes. That's the kind of love the king had for everybody.
How did they respond? Do we know?
We do know. They responded by engaging him in a rich dialogue, and when they finished talking to Dr. King, they understood his point of view, and they went and got registered to vote because Carl Stokes was on the ballot to become the first black mayor of a major city, and in fact, he won. But Dr. King talked those prostitutes into getting registered to vote and voting for Carl Stokes. And then the sad part of the story is what happens the night that Carl Stokes wins and the disrespect he afforded Dr. King.
We have an email from Pauline who says, I think that Dr. King was hugely impressed by the teachings of Gandhi. I was discussing the legacy of Gandhi with two young Indian friends who told me that his teachings are largely ignored in modern-day India, where the pursuit of wealth is a huge priority. What a tragedy, she writes.
Sounds like America, doesn't it? We ignore King, and it's all about wealth and commodities, and it's sad. It's sad. These numbers in this country are unsustainable. If Martin were here now, he'd be telling us that poverty is threatening our very democracy, that poverty is a matter of national security, and that these numbers are not sustainable. 1% of the people cannot continue, Rose, to own and control 40% of the wealth. Put another way, the top 400 wealthiest Americans have wealth equivalent to the bottom 150 million of us. That may be an oligarchy, that may be a plutocracy, that is not a democracy, and these numbers are not sustainable in the long run.
Well, thank you for the email, Pauline, and thank you for giving us a call, Ed. I'm speaking with Tavis Smiley about his latest book, Death of a King, The Real Story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Final Year, and it looks like we've got full lines. We'll have one open in just a couple of minutes at 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear next from Joe in San Francisco. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Mr. Smiley, I listen to your radio program every week. I thank you for that. And in 1967, I was a very angry black youth. I was very politically aware. And Dr. King's speech at Riverside Church really moved myself and also the circles that I moved in. And we actually were drawn closer to his radicalism, or at least the radical voice in that speech. And we're very devastated upon his assassination. My question is, can you please, Mrs. Smiley, talk a little bit about Dr. King's relationship with Dr. William Pepper and Dr. William Pepper's argument that Dr. King's assassination was not by a lone assassin, but in fact an act of state? Thank you.
Yep. We do not, in this text, get into the assassination because what's beautiful about this book in the way it's written, different than any other book written about King before, is that we put you in real time in his inner circle. So everything that Doc experiences, you experience. As a matter of fact, in the book, he's never even referred to as Dr. King. He's Doc. I want to humanize him, take him off that pedestal. And so every page of this book, you are in the space with him. And whatever he's experiencing, whatever he's going through, you're right there with him. The story is told in real time for the last 12 months of his life. And so the book ends when that bullet hit him in the head on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. Now, there's a wonderful epilogue in the book. I think the epilogue, quite frankly, Rose, is one of the best parts of the book, and you have to read it. I don't want to spoil it for you. And by the way, when you get the book, do not read the epilogue first, because I said that. I don't want you to ruin the story for you. It ends when he's assassinated, and so we don't get into the conspiracy issues or the assassination issues. We just don't do that because that's not what this particular book is about.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Joe. Let's go next to Mike in Redwood City. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How are you? It's an honor to talk to you, Travis.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to say that I think that the same people that killed John Kennedy killed Martin Luther King, because it was, as you mentioned, in 1967 that Dr. King made his speech against the Vietnam War. And it wasn't until 1968 that the publications you mentioned, the New York Times, the Washington Post, CBS, etc., finally came out against the Vietnam War. Do you have any thoughts on that, that that's why Dr. King was killed, because he came out against the Vietnam War?
No doubt about it. That's why that connection from April 4, 67 to April 4, 68 is such a is so enduring and searing, quite frankly. He gives this Beyond Vietnam speech in 67. He's dead a year to the day later in April of 68. And so there's always been this fascination with what that means, that both of these dates are tied to April 4, 1 year apart. There's no doubt in my mind that his being against the Vietnam War did not make anybody love him among the circles of the powers that be. But they also killed him because he was on his way to Washington. He was very much involved in trying to roll out. He was just days away from rolling out his Poor People's mm-hmm. Campaign. Mm-hmm. So we think of Occupy Rose, we think of Occupy in New York in Zuccotti Park, or maybe even protesters in Occupy being maced and hounded by the police in Oakland. But Martin King was going to be the original Occupy by going to the nation's capital and setting up a tent city that they were calling Resurrection City. And he and thousands of others were going to live in those tents on the National Mall until they embarrassed Congress to do something about poverty in this country. And so they didn't want Dr. King coming to Washington to put that kind of imagery of the nation and for the nation on national television every night. And so he got killed just before he got there. But it's just a sad way to end his life on the one hand. On the other hand, the beauty of it is, as I said earlier, that every day with all this hell and hate coming at him, he got up every day and he kept speaking his truth. And for that, I love him.
How did his death affect the Poor People's Campaign?
It no pun intended, it killed it. It just didn't allow it to get off the ground. And so, here we are now. Interesting question, Rose, because this is the 50th anniversary this year of Johnson's War on Poverty. And for all that Johnson got wrong on the Vietnam War that caused Martin to challenge him publicly and privately, he was right about fighting this war against poverty. He now still stands as the last president in this country to get serious about eradicating poverty. Barack Obama talked about it when he ran, but he just got around last December. It took him 6 years, Barack Obama, 6 years as president to give a major policy address on poverty and income inequality, and then he declared it the defining issue of our time. He's right about that, but it took him 6 years to get to that. Dr. King would not have remained silent for 6 years while the President of the United States didn't say much about poverty and wasn't fighting as hard as he should have on the minimum wage, et cetera, et cetera. Martin would not have been silent. I repeat again, if you think I've been tough on Obama, read what Dr. King in this book says about and to Lyndon Johnson. It's a very interesting read.
Thank you for calling in, Mike. I'm speaking today with Tavis Smiley about his latest book, Death of a King, The Real Story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Final Year. Tavis decided to focus on the last year of Dr. King and to bring some of the speeches, the massive speech he gave to light that's very sanitized in the media. You don't hear the media during his birthday repeat his speech when he called the United States the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today and noted that a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website.
This is a rebroadcast episode of Your Call. We don't accept calls at this time.
Margie?
Hi, good morning, Rose. Thank you again for a great show. And Tavis, don't stop asking the hard questions and putting out this type of information. We need more people like that. So thank you for that. I had too wanted to know if you saw a correlation between what happened with JFK and with Vietnam, Martin Luther King. You look at today's president who ran on getting out of the war, but now seems to be escalating. He is a black president. When you tie all those things together and the military mobilization, and I know other people have asked similar questions, so I'm also going to throw this in, which is, what do you see the relationship that exists today with the churches compared to what it was back then with the civil rights movement and now the roles that the churches seem to be playing today, especially the Christian churches?
Yeah, a lot of good questions here. Let me try to do as best I can, as quickly as I can. On the church front, the church is not nearly as involved, the church, whatever that means these days, is not nearly as involved in the social justice movement as it should be. I know there are great examples of churches doing the right thing in the Oakland, San Francisco area, but across the country, writ large, churches are not involved in social justice the way they should be. Now, keep in mind, at the end of Dr. King's life, in the last year, he couldn't get a book deal. He couldn't get a speech. He was not welcome in churches across this country. They shunned Dr. King. Even in the church, they shunned him. And so, you know, he had to navigate that as part of his journey as well. But in our time, these churches are eerily silent on these questions of social justice and certainly on questions of war and peace. But what really saddens me, if I can even be more specific, is that inside of Black America, and this is also true for progressives writ large, we've been far too silent. Martin King talked in that speech, April 4, 67, about a time to break silence, a time to end the silence. His point was, and he said, that sometimes silence is betrayal. Silence is betrayal. And I think, quite frankly, we are betraying our president the longer and the more silent we are on the military-industrial complex in this country and on the use of these drones that are killing innocent women and children. We're betraying the president. We're betraying the best of America when we remain silent. And Dr. King would not have done that. So I hope that that we'll figure this out, because it's startling to me very quickly, Rose, that inside of Black America, that Black people are silent on the war question. They don't want to challenge the president, all out of deference to his being an African American. But something is wrong in my own community when people have gone silent, or worse yet, support the president in this increasing military excursion, these increasing military excursions around the globe. It's just fascinating for me to have written this book to see how vocal Martin was and how quiet everybody else is.
Well, and you've got a lot of these people on your show, Tavis, on a regular basis. I mean, what are you hearing from them behind the scenes? What are you asking them point blank why they're being silent?
Everybody has their own spin. They have their own spin. His hands are full. What is he to do? These are difficult decisions. You know, we have to fight terrorism. I mean, you hear the whole range. My concern is that too many leaders, certainly in my community, in Black America, too many leaders go see the president and they come out of the White House advancing his talking points. Dr. King never did that. He went to the White House for meetings all the time, but he came out and told his truth. Now we've got Black leaders who are basically surrogates for the Obama administration. That's not what Black leadership is all about. It's about speaking truth to power. The last sermon, very quickly, that Dr. King was going to preach, it's in the book, it's going to knock you out. If you're driving, hold on tight to the steering wheel. If you're sitting down, grab the arm of your chair. He's going to mess you up. This is going to mess you up. Dr. King is assassinated, Rose, on a Thursday night in Memphis, as you know. Had he made it back to Atlanta on Sunday morning to his church, Ebenezer, had he made it back, he was going to preach a sermon. How do we know this? Because every week he called his sermon in by Thursday or Friday so they could get it printed in the Sunday morning bulletin. So that one of the last calls he made from the Lorraine was back to his church. He talked to his secretary and talked to his dad, his co-pastor, Daddy King. And the sermon that he was going to preach, had he made it back to Atlanta that Sunday, was entitled, Why America May Go to Hell. Hmm. Why America May Go to Hell. His thesis: if we don't get serious about racism, militarism, and poverty, this democracy is done. America may go to hell. Back to your point, Rose, you read his quote earlier, read my quote earlier from the book. I mean King's quote, I'm sorry, that a nation that, you know, does what we're doing day in and day out is approaching spiritual death. So he was going to preach a sermon called Why America May Go to Hell. Now, you tell folk that the I Have a Dream guy was going to preach a sermon called Why America May Go to Hell, they can't get that, Rose.
Yeah, well, and, when you talk about this, it makes me think about how things have been so dumbed down and how our expectations are so low right now. What are your thoughts on what would actually change what we're dealing with? And please, I mean, other than voting and calling your congressperson,
sure,
because our guests
sure.
always say that, and I'm sure they say that mm-hmm. on your show. But a lot of listeners say, okay, we need something else. That's, you know, we do that and we're stuck.
It's not that complicated. It's really very simple. It's tough to do, but the solution is simple. King said all the time that life's most persistent and urgent question is, what are you doing for others? I put it this way, that I don't believe that we come into the fullness of our own humanity, Rose, if we can't revel in the humanity of every other fellow citizen. So when King is talking about love, he's not talking about some syrupy notion. What he's talking about is that fact that love means everybody is worthy, that all life has equal value. Everybody is worthy just because, not because of your last name, where you went to school, how much money you have, who your mom and them are, what kind of access you have, how many degrees you have, how much money you make, what zip code you live in. None of that matters. If love means that everybody is worthy just because, then everybody ought to have access to high-quality health care. Everybody ought to have access to an equal high-quality education. Everybody ought to have access to a living wage job, not a minimum wage job. People should not be subjected to living next to environmental dumps, etc., etc. If everybody is equally worthy just because, and that is our definition of love, imagine how this country would change if we could ever operationalize that and put that at the center of our politics.
Hey, if you framed it that way, I bet the majority of the people would be behind you.
I don't know.
We have one more caller. Let's take Al in San Francisco. Hi, Al. Welcome to the show.
Good morning to both of you. I just wanted to make a comment. You know, I'm from the Midwest originally. I was a soldier in Vietnam when Dr. King was assassinated. I was on Firebase 15 in the Central Highlands shooting defensive fires for the 1st of the 8th Infantry. I was working a swing shift. When I woke up to go to my shift, I took a walk around the perimeter of the firebase when the news had been received earlier in the day. And I want you to know that line sergeants were weeping, black men and white men alike, at the news of this horrible event. This is something that I've always fought for. I was just now at the VA in San Francisco receiving excellent health care, which we should all have, every one of us, as citizens of this United States. But it opened my eyes. When I saw these hardened line sergeants weeping over grief for Dr. King.
Wow. Well,
that's my comment.
Thanks.
And Tavis, thank you for your book.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks
Appreciate
so much,
it.
Al. Tavis, we have about a minute left.
I just want to thank him for his service, number one. I think that Dr. King was abundantly clear, and this comes through in the text. He understood the predicament that these young boys and young boys then, now young men and young women are in. They have signed up to serve their country, and they have to do what they're told to do. But our leaders are the ones who put them in harm's way, and we've got to make better decisions so that we can make this country a country that we can all be proud of, one day living up to the best of its ideals. But we'll never get there if we don't deal with that triple threat, even now, of racism, poverty, and militarism.
Tavis Smiley is author of the new book, Death of a King, The Real Story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Final Year. Tavis is host and managing editor of Tavis Smiley on PBS and The Tavis Smiley Show from Public Radio International. He's the author of 16 books, including his newest, Death of a King. He decided that it was really important to take a look at the last year of Martin Luther King Jr.'s final year. Tavis, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.